Markov Company Gallery in Portland. VS Guitar Duo members Vadim and Sasha Kolpakov will provide a masterclass of the Russian and Romani 7-string and 6-string guitar techniques. Students will learn the rhythms of guitar traditions such as flamenco, gypsy jazz, and Russian Romani, and more. Again, that's the VS Guitar Duo Masterclass on Sunday, April 22nd from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Markov Company Gallery, 625 Northwest Everett Street, number 111 in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from Indigo Gardens, specializing in growing bee-friendly flowers and inspired seasonal floral design. Located in East Portland, Indigo Gardens. For more information, the number is 503-421-1435 or indigogardenspdx.com.
Hello. Hey, good morning. This is KBOO, that's two O's, 90.7 FM on your dial. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. That's Abe Pryor. I'm Joe Uris. We want to hear from you, 231-8187. But what we're going to talk about mostly, although Hannity keeps coming into my mind.
Yeah, it's kind of a sideshow, but it's a really amusing one. So we touch on that a little bit.
Yeah, later. A little bit. You know, yeah. Fox propaganda machine.
Yeah, you know, I'm starting to think that maybe Fox News isn't really fair and balanced after all.
Oh, you don't think it's fair and balanced? But they say they're fair and balanced.
Yeah, well, we'll get to that a little bit later.
Okay,
but but first we want to talk about the latest chapter in the book of Infinite War.
Infinite War, unending war, war for the glory of what? The empire. Anyway.
Well, war for the glory of bank accounts.
What I'm going to do here is talk a little Syrian history, not believing that most of us know much about Syria, though we should. First of all, Syria was part of the ancient empires of the Assyrians, the Egyptians, the Hittites, and so on.
The Romans.
The Romans, yes, yep. Of course, the Romans. And it had a Greek phase. Mm-hmm. It was a place, a crossroads of trade and of wealth based on the Tigris and Euphrates rivers and so on. And in fact, in modern times, after World War I, the French and the British, at the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, of which Syria was a part, divided up that area into mandates, that is to say, places they would govern and control. And Syria fell into the French mandate.
Hmm.
And thereafter, there were resistance movements, nationalist movements, and largely led in the context of Islam. And that went on and on until power finally, I'm really, really abbreviating this, until finally, in modern times, in 1920, there was a Syrian Republic, and it gained independence in 1946. And the Assad family took over pretty much, and it entered in 1940. Also in 1946, it entered into the Arab-Israeli War, and 48 it continued to exist in the 50s and 60s under the leadership of something which most Americans don't understand, which is the Ba'ath Party, B-A-A-T-H, with a thing between a little. Thing between the two parts of the A's.
An apostrophe.
Okay. That's the thing. Right. And the Ba'ath Party is pretty interesting. First of all, it is Arab. It is Islamic. It argues for a pan-Islamic world. And at the same time is largely socialist. It has, in every society where Ba'ath power existed, and the most prominent ones that we could name, for a short time, Egypt, but the most powerful ones we could name would, of course, be Syria and Iraq. In both cases, huge numbers of people were employed through the government. The free enterprise sector had less control, less power than in many other places. Ba'athism is not to be associated with, nor mistaken by the kind of Sunni developments that we see in the Islamic states elsewhere, particularly Saudi Arabia.
But the Ba'ath Party is itself aligned with the Sunni.
Well, now that's an interesting point.
Faction of Islam, sect. Islam.
Yeah, well, sect, religion, I don't know. Sunni, yes, it's largely Sunni, but the family that rules is Alawite, and they are actually Shia.
Hmm.
And they are 12 imams Shia, which means they are all awaiting the return, as in Jesus coming back at the end of time. They're awaiting the return of the mysterious hanging out somewhere in the neo space of the 12th imam. This is a real thing.
Hmm.
And they are also into, as Shia, punishing themselves for their failure to gain control of all of Islam. This division, which I don't think I even knew about when I was younger, this division is very real, very serious. Iran, for example, is a Shia nation.
Mm-hmm.
And the Alawites are a sect within Shia, and the dominant religion in the region actually is not Sunni at all. It is really a combination of a lot of things. There are Christians. There are various sects. By the way, the peoples that live there include the Kurds. And involved in the current war, I'm really going to skip a lot here, but in this current war, the powers that are involved include Russia and Iran and the United States and Great Britain and France and to a great extent other powers of the region. It has been a struggle by independence-seeking Arab peoples to gain power from the Assad family. And the Assads have only ruled for two generations.
But and they are the heads of the Ba'ath Party in Syria, are they not?
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
But not elected.
No, well, not elected. No.
Not elected. And this struggle has gone on for a long, long time. It turns out that the current Assad, Bashar al-Assad, and their family are ruthless in maintaining power. How ruthless? Well, they're willing to kill all their own people, destroy all of their cities.
Yeah, essentially.
Meanwhile, the other power that is operating in the region, which is a very effective military force, are the Kurds. The Kurds are seeking their own nation state within the region, which would be made up of parts of Iran, parts of Iraq, and parts of Turkey. That really makes the Turks upset.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, parts of Syria. So in this mix, where there are armed camps, armed groups, and of course the new Islamic caliphate, which mm-hmm. we drove out of the region more or less, all of these are in contest for the country. And for a long, long time, it has been known that Assad will use chemical weapons. The two weapons that seem to be his favorites are really nasty. Sarin, which is a nerve gas, which, by the way, is essentially operates on a human being like insecticides. It causes immediate destruction of ordinary neurological function. It is it shuts down a variety of systems. The body is flooded with mucus and so on. And the other chemical used is one from World War I, chlorine gas, which is a burning, destructive, lung-destroying chemical, both of which have been used in the region. Now,
heavier than air also.
Oh, yeah.
Which means
if you try to
shelter in a basement or something, you're not going to get away.
Won't work. So you're going to actually literally drown in your own fluids. It's quite nasty. But the fact that this is being used is often in contest. The Russians, for example, deny that it's been used. The United States has twice now attacked facilities for these gases to no real effect, no real damage as far as we can tell. This most recent attack is supposed to be better than the last one, but maybe not. And maybe we didn't get it all, and maybe we can't get it all, because in order to get it in its live form would mean poisoning thousands of people, because, as you say, it hangs to the ground, and it is extremely toxic. So this is the situation. Right now, inspectors are not being allowed in to see exactly what the damage was. So nobody really knows for sure how effective the attack launched this last week really is.
Yeah, there's been all news reporting on the attack and its aftermath. It's all over the map, all sorts of conflicting reports. Some reports claiming even that the site where the chemical weapons were allegedly discharged had been tampered with.
Right.
So that whatever conclusion inspectors reach might not be the accurate one.
Well, that's absolutely true, and it's very difficult to know. Well, first of all, it's difficult to know what's true based on the inspections. The British are not trustworthy. The French are not trustworthy. The Americans are not trustworthy. Soviets are not trustworthy. The Iranians are not trustworthy. The Ba'ath people are not trustworthy. The fundamentalists struggling to gain control of the country are not trustworthy. It's really, really a mysteriously vicious and ugly situation, which all of which really came out of the decision of Cheney and others to easily take Iraq and easily dismiss the Ba'ath Party from power and easily get rid of the armies of Iraq and easily end up in a war, an endless war, which we are still seeing going on in Syria.
Yep.
So it's all a piece of something that logically and reasonably and real politic-wise we shouldn't be involved in. The Russians shouldn't be involved in it. I think a treaty of some sort would reasonably and rationally be a good idea, but it does not seem in the offing.
Yep.
And the Russians are playing a very nasty end game in which, bizarrely, the President of the United States seems to be sort of an ally of Russia, kind of.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because underneath all of this are a number of motives that aren't entirely clear and in some cases are completely hidden. For example, what exactly is Russia's endgame in all of this? How exactly does Donald Trump dovetail with Russia and its plans? We have to remind people, I think, that Syria is a strategically important territory for Russia. It's been a client state for a long time, and it is also the site of the Russian Navy's only Mediterranean base, which is on the Syrian coast. And in addition to that facility, the Russians, I think, maintain at least one other military outpost in Syria. So it's an important strategic location for the Russians. But what does that all have to do with Donald Trump? Or probably more accurately, what does Donald Trump have to do with all of that?
Well, it all depends on whether you believe the peace story.
Well, who knows about that?
I don't know about that.
But look, in the aftermath of the chemical attack last week, there was a lot of bluster coming out of the United States. There was, of course, a military strike in retaliation. Yesterday, the United States ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, announced a new round of sanctions against Russia that Trump has subsequently walked back.
Yes, Trump is...
Within about 48 hours. So... you know, you're really left scratching your head about all of this.
And I wanted to remind people the word Ba'ath, B-A-apostrophe-A-T-H, in English rendering, actually means renaissance. And the idea is a renaissance of the intellectual, the political, the moral, the greatness of the old traditions of Islam. All of which are challenged by the fact that there are two major sects of Islam coexisting in the region, and the fact that the Assad family are part of the minority there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really an incredible mess, which we casually went into for oil, I think, under Cheney, which we cannot get out of, which is an evolving fight between, I think, Russia and the United States, except that this administration is reluctant to challenge the Putin regime.
Right, because of the possibility that there exists some sort of leverage that Russia is able to exert over President Trump.
Yeah, and I want to emphasize, too, that the Ba'ath movement, this renaissance, includes a lot of features of socialism, and I hasten to say this, but it's important, National Socialism, and that when we conquered, for example, Iraq, we fired the entire, more than half of the employed people in Iraq. We fired them, which put them in a position of desperation and anger. And at the same time, we put the Sunni Shia fight into a situation where the Shia were a ruling party. And this led to an enormous and unending war with lots of people being killed and lots of Americans being killed or hurt. And this continues on endlessly, although right now it seems that Iraq is more or less quiet. Meanwhile, on the other corner, there is Saudi Arabia, which is making war to the south of the Arabian Peninsula, which is ruthless, which is powerful, and which we keep selling or giving weapons in huge numbers.
It's a mess.
It's really a mess. Mesopotamia.
Mesopotamia.
Yeah.
Now, I'm glad you mentioned the disbandment of the Iraqi army, because that is a key event in this whole sordid history. That happened in May of 2003.
Right.
We had a guy named Paul Bremer, who was essentially the imperial governor of the newly acquired Iraq province at the time, issued the order to disband the Iraqi army, which, as you mentioned, employed a whole lot of Iraqis who now found themselves out of work.
Well, it was also the huge civil service system, which did a lot of the labor in the society as a whole.
Right. So now they're in what is essentially an occupied, failed state. They're out of work with not a whole lot to do. So what did they do? They became ISIS.
Largely.
Largely.
But remember that there's this enormous struggle always going on within the Islamic world between Shia and Sunni. And that struggle is playing out in what should have been an older thing with a difference of faith, like between Catholics and Protestants, mm-hmm. let's say. It is not the same as that. It is much more militant and much more like our Renaissance times in the Western world. And it's really, really mean. Really mean.
So, yes. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And we should not lose sight of that context. The formation of ISIS out of many disparate factions, including the remnants of the disbanded Iraqi army, of course, went on to seize large swaths of territory in Iraq, in Syria, helped to touch off the Syrian civil war, which in turn displaced millions of Syrians who made their way north into Europe, now against which there is an emerging right-wing and even fascist backlash amongst the governments of Europe. So we can see here how the law of unintended consequences has created an enormous, enormous problem that doesn't show any sign of getting any better.
No, it's the destabilization of Europe, which seemed improbable with the development of a united Europe, is now clearly a problem. Nations like Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, Germany even, France, all of them, Italy, all of them facing this influx of desperate people who are seen as the other. And the other, as we know from the ugly treatment of persons of color in this society, is a bad place to be.
Yes, most definitely. So, especially when you have no home to which to return.
Right.
When your entire town is in rubble.
Yeah, and Assad turns out to be one of the most vicious of these people. The weapon he uses when he is not using chemical weapons, and that's most of the time, are something called barrel bombs. They are essentially old oil barrels that are filled with explosive and pieces of scrap metal. And they are dropped often from helicopters, and they explode in an air burst above the height of people and just rain horror upon individuals in huge amounts, 55-gallon drum of explosives and pieces of metal.
So the Assad was willing to do this to much of his own country.
Yeah.
So that he could rule over the ashes?
I think so. Huh. I have not talked to him lately.
No, you haven't? Okay.
No.
All right.
I don't know his motives for sure, but I also know he's an Alawite, which is this 12th Imam sect within Shia. And he is very, very, very much in the minority in his country, in the region.
Hmm.
The reason why Iran is involved is to reassert Shia dominance as much as possible. Also, I don't want to leave this out, there's the Kurds, who wish to create a nation state out of part, a small part of Turkey, parts of Syria, parts of Iraq, parts of Iran. This is all of it insane and absolutely with no end point in mind.
Yes, and I don't think we can consider the United States to be a rational actor in all of this.
Well,
if we
been.
Ever could.
Yeah, I don't think it ever could.
Most especially now. And there's two factors hanging over all of this that must be taken into consideration. But at the same time are incredibly frustrating because we really don't know what's there. The first is, as I mentioned a little while ago, the exact nature of the relationship between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin and the possibility that Putin might have some piece of information that allows him to exert influence over Trump.
Yeah, and those of us with a salacious mind, of course, think it has something to do with sex or fecal matter or urine or something.
Something. Yeah. And the other factor, of course, is that there's the very distinct possibility that all of this might be the tail wagging the dog, that Donald Trump is engaging in a military action in the Middle East in the hopes that it will... first, cover him in glory, and second of all, distract from the sharks that are circling him in the form of the Mueller investigation.
Right. No, and now there is the discovery that Cohen, his fixer lawyer, who hardly ever practices law, it turns out, the fixer lawyer is, in fact, engaged in a vast campaign involving Fox News, which has an alternative view of the universe, which is listened to by, I don't know, huge numbers of people who choose it over any other rational source of news.
Yes, and specifically in the person of Sean Hannity.
Ah, Sean Hannity!
Now that Bill O'Reilly has been fired, Sean Hannity, he made $36 million last year. He's the highest paid figure on cable television.
Certainly worth it.
Oh, absolutely worth it, yes. Who now, it has been revealed, has secretly been the client of Michael Cohen for some time now.
Right.
When pressed about this, Hannity said on his radio show that no, he knew Michael Cohen very well and trusted him and valued his opinion, but he wasn't a client. There was no official relationship there. Cohen was somebody to whom Hannity would go from time to time when he needed a legal perspective on certain issues, but Hannity was never a client, although he did presume that those conversations were covered by lawyer attorney-client privilege.
It's either one or the other.
It's either one or the other. Again, I'm beginning to think that maybe Fox News isn't fair and balanced after all. We have a listener who, with a question, wanted to know what role Israel has played in all of this, and are they trustworthy? I can't really answer what role Israel has played in all of this, but I think I can say that no, Israel is not trustworthy either.
Israel, ironically, one of the great hopes of a lot of people after World War II, from its very beginning, presented a propagandistic lie, suggesting that Palestine was empty, that there were no people there, that not so, and that all these people who had been dispossessed and survived the Holocaust should have a homeland. The idea of that had a great deal of support from the United States, from Harry Truman, from various people, and that movement, which is Zionism, which began as a significant movement in the late 1800s, saw its fruition in the creation of the State of Israel. Immediately thereafter came the disaster, as it's known in Arabic, which was the war against Israel, and then there have been several of these wars, and in every case, the Arab states have lost against a far more brilliantly organized, far more zealous, and far more better weaponed, I would say, army, supported by the United States in that region. It has been unstable and uncertain for a long, long time. The present situation is that there is a isolated, more radical area in Gaza, so-called Gaza Strip, and a more conservative, relatively speaking, a Palestinian state with its capital at Jerusalem. Now, into that enters Trump, the absolute dumbest president ever, I think, and he decides, oh, he will go with the moneyed supporters of Israel, and he will make the capital of Israel at Jerusalem, which then ignites all of the religious fervor, all of the religious concern, because Temple Mount, which is, by the way, includes the area of the last wall of the traditional temple of Israel. The Temple Mount is, in fact, the place where allegedly Muhammad ascended to heaven.
Yeah.
So that makes it very important, religiously speaking.
It does.
And that makes it, when it's religiously important in a world where religion is important, that's important. This is not resolvable through rational discourse. This has to be resolved in an external way somehow. Meanwhile, pardon me, the Russians are, I think, delighted to be playing in this field. They have ambitions of their own. And Trump, and this business about, I make jokes about the P thing and so on, but there's something there. There's something going on where Trump doesn't seem willing to take on Putin. We are certainly militarily and economically well in advance of Russia, yet we don't seem to follow up. We do not seem to be ready to make demands and to enforce them on the oligarchic Russian system. So it's not just the Mesopotamia. It is an unending Mesopotamia.
All right.
I'm really depressed myself now.
All right. Well, enough of that then.
Okay, I'll hold my breath.
This is Abe and Joe Talk Radio Program. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. First up today, Pear. Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
What's on your mind?
Well, you left out a pretty important event.
Okay.
Back in 1949, Syria had only been independent for 6 years at that time. they had a democratically elected president.
Yes, that's true, very briefly.
His name was Shukri al-Kuwatli, and he was overthrown by the CIA.
I think that's true. I don't have that in my notes, but I think you're right.
And he was overthrown, and his successor, a fellow named al-Zaim, he ruled with a kind of brutal way. And then he was overthrown, and then eventually Kuwatli came back into power, and the U.S. and Britain tried again to overthrow him in 55 or 56. So this led to a series of coups and counter-coups. Hafez al-Assad didn't even come into the scene until the 70s, after this about 20 years of instability.
Yeah, you know, you're right. I did leave it out, and that is true, what you just said.
So, I mean, and the issue, one of the issues in the overthrow of al-Kuwatli had to do with a pipeline that he was blocking a proposed pipeline from Saudi Arabia up through Syria, you know, eventually into Europe. So, you know, this whole unending series of disasters was really touched off by the U.S.
Yeah, and I tend to, in my own analysis, blame the Western powers post-World War I. World War I was an unnecessary and ugly war. It introduced chemical weapons, by the way, into the world, including chlorine. And, in fact, the divvying up of the Middle East, as it was then called, was an arbitrary thing carried out by the surviving successful powers who won World War I. Meanwhile, that same war introduced... Well, let me finish, Pierre, and I'll let you go. It's really important to understand World War I gave us the birth of the Soviet Union as well. Now, go ahead.
Well, that's where the Kurds got stiffed in that peace. I guess they were originally, they were going to get their homeland, and then... Kemal Ataturk raised loud objections,
yes.
And the Western powers decided that they needed him more than the Kurds, and so the Kurds got shut out of the whole thing.
Well, that's correct, and Ataturk modernized what was left of the centers of the Ottoman Empire, which was Turkey, modernized it and changed the language form from Arabic writing to Roman script, the kind we have, and changed a lot of things and made sure that it could lock out the Kurds. The Kurds had a certainly legitimate need for a nation state of their own. The Kurds, in fact, are more modern in their thinking and their traditions. They, for example, use a lot of fierce woman fighters. I don't know if they can call that a modern or a good thing, but they treat women more equally than men, counter to the traditions traditional Shia or Sunni Islam.
Well, there's something else going on here, too. I mean, there's all this, the U.S. acting in other countries in the region. You know, they've been overthrowing leftist, secular rulers all over the place. A good example was in Iraq. It was ruled by Abdul Karim Qasem, who was a military man. They'd overthrown the king that was imposed by England.
Right.
And some Iraqi people I know say that he was the last honest leader that Iraq ever had. Well, in 59, the CIA overthrew him. They hired a young thug named Saddam Hussein to assassinate him. And Saddam, they set him up in an apartment across from the office building where Qasem worked. And the assassination plot failed. Saddam Hussein was able to escape to Egypt eventually, helped by the CIA, where he hung around, and then later on he was installed as ruler of Iraq. And the same thing happened in Iran when Mossadegh was overthrown. And this led to the Shah and eventually the mullahs. So you had this thing where the U.S. is plotting against, you know, leftist, secular leaders in favor of the Islamic theocrats.
Well, and I don't think the U.S. I think the U.S. policy was very much focused during the period you're talking about on defeating the Soviet Union and getting the oil.
Right.
And it was ignoring all the other factors that were so important in the region, including the right of self-governance.
Well, the oil is important. It's the whole thing about opposing communists is that these secular leftists who are not really communists, but they were considered soft on communism. You know, John Foster Dulles is going around saying that, you know, there are no neutrals. You know, you're either with us or against us. And these guys were not sufficiently with us, so they were overthrown.
Well, and also remember that the Ba'ath Party really is a national socialist movement under the precepts of traditional Islam. Listen, Empire, I'm going to let you go and give some other folks a chance. I want to thank you for your points.
Can I just ask one more question?
Sure.
If Putin can blackmail Trump, why can't the CIA do the same?
Why can't the CIA blackmail Trump?
Yes, exactly.
Well, I would imagine the CIA probably could.
Trying, okay. Probably.
That's something to think about, that Trump is being blackmailed by our own people, too. So,
well,
you know,
I don't.
War party, in a sense.
Yeah, I don't know about that. That's speculation. It's interesting. It may be right. It may be wrong.
Hey, thanks for the call. Excellent call. Wonderfully researched.
Oh, yeah. Pear is a valuable resource.
He is. Okay.
You're going to take a break here and read some news?
Well, yeah, I was just thinking about what he said about why, you know, if Putin can blackmail Trump, why couldn't the CIA? And it just flashed through my head. Oh, but Hillary's emails. All right.
No. Don't go there.
At 9 on Alternative Radio, journalist Ramzi Baroud looks at decades of settlements, collective punishment, housing demolitions, walls, and barriers, and asks, where do Palestinians go from here? At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Stage and Studio presents an environmental documentary special, Alaska Water Wars, Stories from Bristol Bay. At 11:30 on Art Focus, Joseph Gallivan interviews Silly Pines and Crystal Rutland about Design Week Portland 2018. And tomorrow morning, we have something very special.
What's that?
KBOO's Lisa Loving will host a live forum with candidates for the Portland City Council here live in the KBOO studios.
Boy, she's brave.
Yeah, she's... Well,
she's brave.
And she's not going to let anybody wiggle out for anything.
I hope not.
This should be a really interesting... conversation.
Well, it's
that was so articulate.
I meant
it. That
to
was
be.
Profound.
I think so.
That's why you. Never mind. All right. So submit your questions on Facebook, and those questions will be asked to the candidates live on the air. That is tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. right here on KBOO 90.7.
I think that's really going to be an interesting discussion.
I agree. Yeah.
Won't call it a debate. Discussion.
Discussion. All right, Mike is up next. Mike, thanks for hanging in.
Oh, yeah. Good morning.
What's on your mind?
Well, you guys are just on a rampage this morning, covered a lot of territory.
Yeah. I wouldn't call it a rampage, but yeah.
Well, a great resource, KBOOS, that's for sure.
Yeah,
and,
thanks.
And so
Thank
much
you.
Of the Foxes and alt-right and, you know, crazy stuff on the internet, I could just say, yeah.
That's my line.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I'd
go ahead.
It. Thank you for that. Anyway.
That's called a Bronx cheer, by the way.
My first point was addressed on Pear's last point.
Yeah.
Last caller. Because you were talking about Trump's lawyer and the files, and that could be a bombshell of getting access to that and exposing and shining a light on it. Just imagine what an expose of shining a light on Trump's gangster-style business operations, especially its finance.
Well, I wouldn't call it gangster-style. I'd call it gangster.
Yeah, exactly. It's mob. And the lawyers, old lawyers that brought him up are all mobsters. And that's not me. That's a fact. But the connection with Russia, you know, you don't have to be too in tune, but I do trust, I've been paying attention, I do trust the sources on this because I've been hearing about it for years, is that Trump business operations, no one will bank with him except some German bank.
Deutsche Bank, yeah.
And much of that department is done through money coming to and from Russia.
Right.
So just think if the CIA or whatever could raid their offices.
Well,
but I don't know that it would be allowed to do because these
no,
it
can't. Look, look.
Each other,
the fact of the matter is that there are nation states. There are powerful nation states. There is the European Union. There are all kinds of controls and rational sourcing for much of this. The United States is less and less the superpower it thinks it is, and more prone to disastrous military interventions.
Yeah, and that's what our job is, and the world seems to be. So.
Yeah.
All right, hey, thanks
and
for
oligarchs,
the call.
It feeds the oligarchy somehow. So, you always keep that in mind in any of this stuff.
Oh, indeed, yes.
A serious thing serving.
Oh, yeah, there's a group of already wealthy people who are getting much wealthier every day as all of this goes on.
Well, yeah, and we're not any of them.
No.
Okay,
I
listen.
Thought, years ago, I bought a little bit of stock in Bowflex, which became Nautilus. But, you know, Raytheon and north of Grumman, I just can't stomach doing. Anyway, thank you.
Okay, thanks for the
thanks
call.
Thanks for the call.
231-8187.
All right, up next we have Barth. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. A long intro that was almost exhaustive in scope and really excellent.
Well, I don't know. It was okay. It was okay. I left a lot.
Well, but compared to the idea of background that one gets on regular news or
We're way ahead of regular news. No, I agree with you there. I think that the current degree of rational discourse coming out of the major news sources, particularly on the air, is terrible. And the fact that there are two universes of reality here, one, the real world, and the other, the one that Fox and others are promoting, is very scary.
Well, I think there's probably multiple universes because there's lots and lots of outlooks in the world, you know.
That's true.
The Assad regime, the Russian regime, you know, everybody's got their own take or projection that they want people to agree with. You know, I mean, in what other alternative universe could the Bush administration be cleansed and even looked at fondly compared to the Trump administration?
Good point. Very good point.
They put a bunch of this stuff into place. They obviously weren't the first. But, you know, the idea of energy and money and national currency and wealth going up to the, you know, upper 1% was in full steam during the Bush administration. And Trump is more obvious about it. And, you know, he's a business clever person, but he just is such a defective human being in terms of his ability to cope and his ability to rule, to govern. I mean, there's not much there. His idea of the capital of Israel being Jerusalem, and you said that it can't be solved by rational means because of the religious overtones. Well, if there were any rational means coming out of Washington right now, they would not be able to be put into use for that purpose. But there aren't any. I mean, it's just so crazy.
Well, it is crazy. I mean, a part of the craziness, by the way, is increasing the war constantly. And another piece of craziness is the fact that John Bolton, who has never seen a war he doesn't like, is now the national security advisor to a president who's never seen a war he doesn't like because he's never been in one.
Right. And
I mean, he has bad bone spurs, you know.
Yes. And just as a side effect, you said Hannity's making about 36 mil a year.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you take off a couple of days for holidays, that's about 100K a day.
Well, sure. And he's certainly worth it.
That's a good gig if you can get it.
I've been wishing for that gig for years. I mean, I would betray all the great causes to which I support if somebody would give me $30 million.
Well,
I'm viable. I'll sell out. Give me $30 million.
I can be bought.
I'll even take it in Bitcoin, you know.
Okay. I'll let you go. Thanks,
yeah,
for
thanks a lot for the call.
Hey, thanks for the call. Timothy writes in to ask, what will the rebuilding of the Middle East look like if it happens, and who will pay for it? Where are other Middle Eastern leaders in handling their errant neighbors? This will not end until the return of Christ. I say this as a Christian. God will not allow Israel to fall in spite of man's involvement.
Well, that's that's a very religious thought.
Yeah.
I have to say. This is a weird thing that he's raised, and I wasn't going to get into it, but there is a strong movement within religious fundamentalists, Christian fundamentalists in the United States that look toward Israel because it's the place where Jesus will reappear the second time, heralding the end of time.
Indeed. The Jews in control of the Holy Land is one of the preconditions for the return of Jesus.
Right.
So, I mean, Timothy asked this question.
From a religious perspective.
From a religious perspective. But it's not one that should be casually tossed aside here, because this is a very real thing in many people's minds.
Well, it's also the fact that Islam is also engaged in a very religious struggle with two major sects and several minor ones, as well as great nationalist, pent-up nationalist desires. And Saudi Arabia, which is, as close to a fascist state as you could get.
Yeah. And this belief, which is called millennialism.
Yes.
Not to be confused with the generation, the millennial generation here in the United States. This belief, millennialism, I think, is what animates a lot of the never say die support for Israel that you find here amongst conservatives in the United States. You see this sort of thing from politicians all the time about Israel's right to exist, about how we will never abandon Israel as an ally. This sort of thinking that we have to support Israel, the state of Israel, so that Jesus can come again, is a real line of thinking that animates politics in the United States. It was of particular concern during the last Bush administration, as you'll recall, because there are a number of known millennialists, including the president of the United States himself, for whom this was a very real thing. So while a lot of, I for one, might be inclined to put aside a question of God's involvement in the Middle East, because I think if there is a God, he probably wants absolutely nothing to do with the Middle East right about now. This is a real thing for political thinkers.
Well, it is a real, certainly it's a real factor. A thing believed to be real in the real world becomes a real thing when there are weapons and zealots and so on. And in fact, from my perspective, I believe that at this point, realistically, there needs to be a state of Israel. But the state of Israel that I had romantic attachment to was the early Israel, a state where, in fact, there was a democratic socialist government on the part of the Labor Party and limited ambition. Now Israel is a nuclear power who is right now engaging in murderous behaviors against the people of Gaza. So I really have no dog in this fight. Except maybe the Kurds.
Israel operates an apartheid regime.
Yes.
In Palestine.
Absolutely.
Let's not gloss this over. No. It is apartheid. And anybody who thinks that the Palestinians living there are getting a fair shake or live in equal conditions or have equal rights or opportunities to the Israelis, they're wrong.
Well, and also Israel is a Western-style power, and all of the other powers in the region are not. I mean, it's both culturally different, it's politically different. It's a situation where there can never be a resolution unless everybody in the region sits down and talks through a process that is fair and equal. And I don't see that happening.
No. No, I don't either.
So it's very depressing.
It is. So once again, we're going to have to turn to our callers to rescue us.
Yeah, the callers can answer this.
Juan, you're next. Good morning.
I'm going to cheer you guys up real well here. You guys are familiar with white phosphorus?
Yes.
Chemical weapon?
Yeah.
That both the United States and Israel uses?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay, so Israel uses it in Gaza. The United States used it at least in Fallujah and probably in other places in Iraq. But when we do it, it's okay. When Assad does it, it's time to unleash the cruise missiles.
Well, now, you're right. I mean, essentially, the use of chemical weapons is not exclusive to Assad, nor is it exclusive to other nations and not the United States. The world, since World War I, has used chemical weapons a lot. We use flamethrowers to root out Japanese who are hidden in caves in the islands as we retook those regions.
And napalm in Vietnam.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All this is horrible stuff, and all of this is done by us as well as others.
So let's take a step back. The other thing is, look at the countries the United States has gone into in the Middle East. Remember when W made the deal with Gaddafi, they weren't going to pursue any nuclear program in Libya, and there was a deal made.
Yes, I remember that very well. And interestingly, the lesson of Gaddafi, that is, he gave up his nuclear development and then was murdered by a rival tribal peoples, the lesson of that is not lost on the North Koreans, who have
That's
no
right.
reason to give up their nuclear weapons in this circumstance.
Right. And Iran is probably wondering if they did the right thing making a deal not to go nuclear.
I don't think they had much of a choice, actually. But, yeah, I think they are concerned. I think that certainly under this administration, everything that was accomplished with the agreement with Iran is being undone, and we have a kind of weird leadership. I mean, when we, you and I, sit down and rationally discuss the Trump administration's foreign policy, and into that discussion actually enters bizarre possibilities of bizarre sexual behavior, et cetera. It's very creepy, and it makes no real rational sense.
No.
Okay, let me just say two things. White phosphorus, it gets on you, and it burns to the bone, and you cannot put it out, and you cannot get it off.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Okay, and that whether that's as bad as chlorine or not as bad, it's still awfully bad, and we use it.
That's true.
And the second thing, look at the countries in the Middle East. They've all been these modern, you know, Libya had the high, like one of the highest standards of, if not the highest standard of living in Africa. And look at it now. Iraq was a relatively modern country. You know, everybody looks at the obvious, it's the oil, right? I think as much as anything else, it's going in and where it's working, to some degree, erasing it.
Well, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think it is, when I bring up the oil issue, it's because it's the most obvious element. But there's territorial elements, there's ambitions that go well beyond the rational. And the United States currently is facing the fact that it is not the superpower that it once was, mainly because everybody else is catching up.
Yeah.
And the American economy has some serious weaknesses.
All right, yeah. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Timothy writes back to say, God isn't happy with Israelites' behavior, and I would agree, but he's made promises to them. Well, I'd like to submit that any promises made by God to anybody should not factor into any decisions involving statecraft, period.
I see, this steps into a world that I was brought up not to believe in, and that I don't believe in, and that I think is essentially an irrational, not irrational, but irrational approach to world events.
Indeed.
As soon as you enter into these religious commitments, whether it's Christian or Islamic or Buddhist, look at the Buddhist behavior in Myanmar. I mean, the Myanmar, pardon me. I think the fact of the matter is that all of that is extremely dangerous and extremely, because it's not amenable to a rational solution, unresolvable. And that makes me very unhappy. When you put on top of that my real doubts about the godly thing, it's so ugly and so sad and so inhumane and so endlessly warrior-like. That's all I can say about it.
Yeah.
You know, my goodness.
We're a secular state. The less we have to do with theocracies like Israel, the better, I think.
Well, we aren't really a secular state.
But we are.
We are legally a secular state.
We are legally a secular state. We have religious people who live here.
Yeah, but you can look at the some very significant events in American history, the treatment of the Mormons, the development of the Mormon state, as it were, consequent to that, the way in which Catholics were treated for a long, long time in this country, the way in which Jews were treated prior to World War II, and the Irish before them, and so on. When you look at all these things realistically, you realize that the role that religious rationalization has played, even in the United States, is incredible and powerful and bad.
Yeah, I have
to say that. Bad.
Yeah, I would agree. Joe is next. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks very much for the show. I've appreciated the fact that you're doing a lot of clarifying of things, and was glad that Per called in to talk about also this old idea of a pipeline going through Syria too. And I had to pull out, I'm kind of old school, so I pulled out my old world atlas, and I had to look at all the ways these countries are locked up, and remind me of a recent article I'm just still trying to absorb that argues that we're seeing in the beginning of the year of the demise of the nation states. And I think that a lot of the mess that you see there is really about how this is just kind of decomposing before our eyes. So I'm going to stop there, but I have a very succinct question that I'd love for you to take on. Okay. So I always get caught up in this phrase that just gets tossed out in just about any news story. So it's, what exactly are the American interests, or even the French interests, or, and this is the weird thing right now, the British interests? So if we look at the countries that just did the missile attack, what exactly can we just focus on what are, if you were to do the top three interests that each of these countries has, does that illuminate anything for us?
I think I'll take a crack at that, and thank you very much for the call. When you hear that, American interests or British interests or French interests, that is shorthand for commercial interests, meaning some person or group of people let's take the United States, for example, has a going concern in a particular area.
Right.
So when the United States makes a military intervention someplace in the name of protecting American interests, that's what it means, that somebody is making money somewhere and some development has made that that undertaking threatened.
Yeah, and I want to throw something into this
just
because it's not complicated enough. And that is that China is very rational in all of this. They are planning railroads, highways, and pipelines that will move from the Far East all the way into Europe and in Africa, across Africa. This is really happening in the real world at this time, And the United States has nothing to counter that.
No, but that begs a larger question. Is that something we want to counter? Are we entitled to the two global preeminence? Is our global preeminence something that is worth preserving? And if so, what means are worth enacting to do that?
Well, I agree.
That's a big set of questions.
No, I agree with you, except that I don't think entitlement has anything to do with anything. Power has everything to do with everything.
Well, yeah, absolutely it does. Do these developments on China's behalf, do they pose an existential threat to the United States?
They shouldn't. Probably not.
They
rationally, the possibility of an open trade network, the possibility of a more transparent and reasonable and modern system of transportation, et cetera, could make the world a better place for most people, probably everybody, in fact.
Yes.
So what the Chinese are doing, while imperialist, because it's China, is also very rational.
I think that could be a topic for at least an entire show.
Oh, easily. We could talk about that for a long time.
We did. All right, let's go to Francis. Good morning, Francis.
Hi.
Hi.
I would add corporate interest.
Oh, well.
Yeah,
that
was, I thought, implied in what I said. But yes, you're absolutely right.
Yeah. And I'm glad that someone mentioned what happened in Libya. And when we talked about the murder of Gaddafi, we need to also recognize that the CIA influence is in that conflict there. I would, when I first called, I was thinking about how the conflict in North Ireland, where my grandfather, the country where my grandfather was from, they portrayed it as a religious conflict between the Protestants and the Catholics, and that was never what it was about. It was about being oppressed, the oppressors and the oppressed.
Uh-huh.
And the oppressed happened to be mostly Catholics. So, and I think that these wars, a lot of times, those who wish to perpetrate conflict and military-industrial conflict exploit religious differences. And I don't know, I'm trying to figure out how in the world we think we should be involved in that at all, other than the corporate interests you were talking about.
Well, Francis, I absolutely agree with you. And I also think that one of the things that has to be factored into this is the thinking of people like Bernays and others who figured out how to use propaganda to the end of national or large corporate interests, and that is such a dominant force. Every day, anybody who listens to media is assaulted by nonsense, bull you know what, about medicines that will not really cure you, illnesses that do not really exist, and a whole host of things that are not a good idea. All of this is absolutely necessary and central to the current capitalist system, particularly in the West. And I think that with that, we need to understand that we are in an irrational situation. And when you're in an irrational situation where nuclear weapons and powerful, horrible bombs are available, it's very, very bad.
Yes, it is. And the people need to stick together. And I hope that that's what we do. Because at some point, we're going to have to realize that people should have protections equal to those of corporations, because it's come to that point now.
Well, I don't think corporations should have any rights at all, but that's a whole
other
thing.
Right, well, that's what they have right now.
I know.
People have none.
Well, you remember the Supreme Court? Right, the Supreme Court decided that, in fact, corporations are people, which means that they can pour millions of dollars into elections.
Right, and I believe that someone can bring a case to the Supreme Court to reverse that, and I hope that happens.
Okay, I thank you very much for your call. I think we're going to have to end on you because
I think we're
out of time. And
yeah,
you all stay tuned.
Everybody.
The best in music, the best in public affairs programming, all of that brought to you on the station you ought to be supporting more, KBOO.
It's coming from the field that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the
coming up this morning on KBOO, next, it's Alternative Radio. Journalist Ramsey Baroud looks at decades of settlements, collective punishment, housing demolitions, walls, and barriers, and asks, where do the Palestinians go from here? At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Stage and Studio presents an environmental documentary special, Alaska Water Wars, Stories from Bristol Bay. At 11:30 on Art Focus, Joseph Galavan interviews Silly Pines at Crystal Rutland about Design Week Portland 2018. Tomorrow morning, KBOO's Lisa Loving will host a live forum with candidates for the Portland City Council in the KBOO studio. Submit your questions on Facebook, and we will ask the candidates.